This is Mae Bressel, and it's broadcast number 661. It's August the 6th, 1984. This time last year, that's the way we usually begin, this time last year, I had a detailed chart on that program last August about the connections of Johnny Carson and the money that went to DeLorean Motors and the relationship of Carson to his partner in the banking business, Henry Bushkin, Jack Catane Jr. of Organized Crime, and the fellow from the part of TMX company, shares owned by DeLorean that went channeled down to money to start DeLorean Motors, and Robert Durand, and the connection of these various people in Hollywood, in Chicago, in Ireland, and the relationship of those people to funding the DeLorean Motors. And of course, there was a lot more to the DeLorean Motors than is ever going to come out in this trial. The trial just is limited to whether or not he was buying these narcotics on his own. And the secret of the real John DeLorean isn't going to come out at all, I'm sure. Also, last year, I was talking about missing millions and billions, specifically the Vatican billions, the DeLorean millions, Mark Rich's millions. Those things are still secret. It's a year later, and they're still secret. I was discussing the DeLorean investigation written up in the Monterey Herald, where they were looking for $17.5 million that was missing. They still haven't accounted for that money, and I had tried to explain leads that I had to the Detroit FBI and called them looking for money in a Swiss bank. I had the name of the courier and the recipient of this money that allegedly came from Klaus Barbie and was put in a Swiss bank. Of course, they would never investigate that. Charges against Johnny Carson's lawyer were dismissed, Henry Bushkin, and his connections with the bank violations were dropped. I also was talking a year ago about Henry Kissinger and his oil deals in the early 1970s with the inflated oil prices, dealing oil to Iran through the Mideast crisis, which is an important story, and this comes up again with Mark Rich, who made his profits at the time of the Middle East crisis, and also when Henry Kissinger was advising Richard Nixon during the Watergate crisis possibly go to war in the Mideast, and that would divert the Watergate scandal. That was a possibility that people in Washington were afraid of. He'd use the war as a diversionary against the impeachment process. And that came out this week in part of the transcript of the hearings on the air. But the inflated oil prices that we were left with after 1973-74 had to do with Henry Kissinger and Mark Rich and Gerald Ford, that combine of people who have profited by various things that they've done together through the years that they have never been. Well, Mark Rich is wanted in trial for his various activities, but he's wanted in New York. But this last week, Mark Rich had a subpoena sent to the Swiss government to have him sent home extradited for trial. For the figure varies between $60 to $80 million of taxes unpaid in this country, and the Swiss government refused to take the subpoena because it was written in English, and they said that's not the official Swiss languages. It should be in German, French, or Italian, and our United States government lawyers don't even know that. So what happened was the subpoena was sent home, and they said that would set us back. Well, in one day you can get a translator, so I don't know what would set us back. Now, because of certain circumstances that have happened this week and stories in the news, I have to back up. I want to continue the Henry Kissinger story. I started 2 weeks ago on the Anglo connections, the English connections and Nazi connections to Henry Kissinger. I didn't forget it, and I promise you I'll be doing it soon. And also, last week I started on the appointments of Ronald Reagan. We went down a bunch of them, just their names, and I'm going to go to them in detail. Ann Burford is down and out of her ocean and atmospheric appointment, so we don't have to worry about her, just who follows her. But as I say, there were stories in the news this week that take precedence even over the appointments, so I'm going to run down those and then go back to the appointments if I have time at the end of the program. But we will continue those. This is the anniversary this week of the bombing at Hiroshima. There's going to be a lot of celebrations on the news, and by the time some of you get these tapes, the news will be over about that. There is a book called Hot Embers, The Chronicle of a Covert Race for Atomic Weapons. It's published in Moscow, and it's a book that came out this year on the grab to make the first atomic bombs and how the United States and British and the Germans were working to make the Manhattan Project, the atomic bomb. Now, there was an article in New Times magazine called Shadows on a Hiroshima Bridge. And the article states, April 25th, 1945, humankind will never forget it. That's the day that the Russians met the Americans and British to defeat the Hitler's Reich. That's where they all met together in Germany, plowing from the east and west, April 25th, 1945. The article says, few people know, however, that on that same distant April day when these people were meeting, delegates were listening to recordings of President Truman's speech in San Francisco. The United Nations chapter was opening up on that day, April 25th, 1945, starting the United Nations with a conference to draft a charter for the international organization. But while the charter meeting was going and Truman had made a recording for those people, he was in Washington, D.C., meeting with War Secretary Henry Stimson and General Leslie Groves in the Oval Room of the White House, and they were talking about making and delivering the atomic bomb. In 4 months, this book states, Stimson reported the United States would in all probability have the most powerful weapon mankind had ever known. Now, Henry Stimson was the man behind the power behind Herbert Hoover from World War I and behind the political escalation of John J. McCloy, who later was on the Warren Commission. He was the American Chancellor to Germany, and he was to release the top Nazis from the German prisons. While they were meeting, they were discussing what they would do about the atomic bomb and that they would demonstrate the weapon to blackmail the Soviet Union. The Manhattan Project was going ahead, and they had $2 billion earmarked to make those bombs that were to fall. Now, there is a man who was in Hollywood making movies, Emmanuel Zacina, and he wanted me to work on a story with him. He was from Nicaragua, and we'd done that Howard Hughes movie, and he told me that the Germans had the atomic bomb and that this is in the National Archives in Washington, but they didn't want to drop it in Europe because they were afraid that then Europe would be polluted or radiation. So they had delivered it to the United States. He said they referred to it as their little pineapple, delivered it. We didn't make that bomb for the Manhattan Project. According to him, in the National Archives, is evidence that the bomb was all ready to go. And in this story, this new book that has just come out on making the bomb, it tells how the president sat with Mr. Stimson discussing what they would do in a few months with the bomb. Now, the book goes on. Meanwhile, the Manhattan Project was being rushed along when, as soon as the war was over, the Nazi uranium project didn't bear fruit, but the Manhattan Project was rushed along. For in 1944, when the Red Army was inflicting on the fascists one defeat after another, the American scientists voiced doubts as to whether it was necessary to use the atomic weapons. But Niels Bohr, B-O-H-R, opposed the weapons. So did Albert Einstein and Leo Szilard, A-R-D. But the Pentagon did not oppose it. They didn't heed their opinion. In 1944, that's 1 year before the war was over and 1 year after the Nazis had gone underground, the so-called ALSOS mission, A-L-S-O-S mission, was a scientific intelligence body, was set up to accompany the advancing troops of the United States and collect data on the uranium project and find their researchers and take them to the United States. Among them were SS Sturmfuhrer Wernher von Braun, who has later played a leading role in the multi-stage ballistic missiles, and former Nazi Colonel General Walter Dornberger, creator of the cruise missile. On June 16, 1945, on the evening of the Potsdam Conference, Truman knew what we were going to do and how we would use the bomb. On August 6, that's the anniversary this evening, And August the 9th, Hiroshima and Nagasaki were dropped without any military necessity whatsoever. But the important thing about this new book is that the same people, Wernher von Braun and General Dornberger, were being rounded up as early as 1945 through this particular group that was going along with the troops and gathering the scientists. We know that Reinhard Gehlen was salting away the names of his particular agents, but these men were part of the plan to work, come to this country and work on the bomb and the delivery system like we have deployed the missiles now with the atomic warheads on them. So what you have is this Wernher von Dornberger then went to the Dallas-Fort Worth area. He employed Michael Payne at Bell Helicopter. Payne was the host of Lee Harvey Oswald. And Wernher von Braun is mentioned in the Torbett document in the story of the assassination cabal. Working with the Defense Industry Security Command, these two men have been named as a part in the murder of John Kennedy, and Alan Dulles of the Warren Commission was arranging for them to sweep up the scientists, these particular people related to the atomic bomb, and Henry Stimson, the power behind Herbert Hoover and John J. McCloy, was part of that decision in the White House, so that while people were meeting at the United Nations and trying to think that we would have a world of peace, it was already decided what we would use the bomb for, to blackmail the Russians, and how we would use it. Now, in addition to the anniversary of the atomic bombs being dropped, this week is the anniversary of Richard Nixon leaving the White House. August the 8th is the date that he left the White House. There was a series on television out here, and maybe nationally, I don't know, 3 hour on Richard Nixon and the impeachment hearing, 1 hour on the impeachment hearing, and 3 hours on the Watergate story and how it unraveled. But there's certain points of the Watergate story I want to bring out because it is the anniversary, August the 8th, when Nixon left the White House. The first thing is that James McCord was on television briefly, and they did not say on this version of the movie when he was introduced to break the Watergate story in March of 1973. He said, "I have with me Bernard Fensterwald, who is from the Committee to Investigate Assassinations." Bernard Fensterwald was at my home in September 1970, and I have reason to know, and of course everybody who studies him knows his role with the Central Intelligence Agency now and before. He represents Marianne Paisley, the widow of John Paisley. He was McCord's attorney. He was James Earl Ray's attorney, the man charged with killing Martin Luther King. Also, that was the first break in the Watergate story, was when McCord started talking. Also, they had John Dean on television telling how he believed that there were tapes in the White House and how Alexander Butterfield had taped the president. And they just passed that up just kind of casually. And the role of Alexander Haig in bringing Butterfield from Australia, when Richard Nixon was elected and saying, "Come on in, we need you in the White House," they called him just a low-level employee who works for Federal Aviation. They didn't say that his job was in the White House until the Dorothy Hunt plane crash went down. Then he was switched to be head of Federal Aviation while he investigated what was an outright murder of a CIA bag lady. And some of you know this history and some of you don't, and it bears repeating in case you forgot it. Now, in the Henry Kissinger book, The Years of Upheaval, published in 1982 by Little Brown, it's his story of the White House Watergate years. And in there, just there's a couple of sentences that are very pertinent to Henry Kissinger in this his period in the White House as National Security Advisor. It said that when, in the growing loneliness, when Nixon needed a keeper at the gate, he was there to help him. You can imagine. It was reflected, his loneliness and how to handle him was reflected in the decision to bring in Alexander Haig to replace Robert Haldeman as the chief of staff. Al Haig and I, that's Kissinger, were long friends. He was my assistant in the National Security Council. He says, when it came time for a chief of staff in the White House, an old mentor, Fritz Kramer, came up with the name of Alexander Haig, Jr., who was then a colonel on the staff at West Point. He was also strongly recommended by Joe Califano and Robert McNamara. Califano, I mentioned his name in relationship to Grenada and to a lot of other matters on the air, even helping Geraldine Ferraro with her electoral committee efforts for Congress in Queens. Whether or not she knows what he is, I don't know, but he was the person who, from the Defense Department, wanted Haig. And this is when the Pentagon became the chief of staff in the White House. Now, Butterfield had bugged the president, and so with the help of Haig and Kissinger and his mentor, Fritz Kramer, that I talk about so much, they were the second stage in bringing the president out. Now, what did you get after they slid the president out? You got Gerald Ford from the Warren Commission, and you got Nelson Rockefeller, who never could have been elected a vice president, and old Carl Albert was bypassed, and they had their old cronies in. Now, there was another man on the television this week who you might or might not have seen. He was Mr. Benz, B-E-N-Z, and he's the fellow that spoke up to Sam Ervin and said, well, didn't the Democrats steal the election in 1960 and 68, talking about the close vote in Chicago that was questionable about John Kennedy. And Sam Ervin said, I don't know much about that. But I want to read you from the Senate Select Committee on Presidential Campaigns a few sentences about the Mr. Benz, B-E-N-Z, the guy who was on the television, because whenever these things are televised, they don't really get to what the congressional hearings were saying. And it's important that he refers to a Donald Segretti who was at Fort Ord, California. The testimony of Mr. Benz, part of it, this is book two of the Senate Presidential Campaign Activities, the Select Committee investigating the 93rd Congress. This is phase two, October the 4th and 9th, 1973. They asked Mr. Benz, he's from Lutz, Florida, he's a dock superintendent, he's the president of the Young Republicans in Texas. Did you receive a phone call from a man who identified himself as Donald Simmons in 1971? And he said yes. And then he said that was an alias for Donald Segretti, who was in California. He was stationed at Fort Ord, California, legal department. Shortly after you agreed to work for Simmons, you received a letter saying California instructions. That's right, from California. Basically, it was a letter saying that I acquire pickets for the rallies that President Nixon might attend in the area. And he also, they did dirty tricks and forged letters and so forth. Who were those pickets that you were to have? They were to have, not tickets, they were to have pickets around the areas where, not only where President Nixon would be, but where the Democrats would be. Who were those pickets? One was Mr. Hearing, and there was a gentleman by the name of Duke. And Mr. Lenzer said to him, and who is this individual named Duke? Did you know his background? He said, they told me he was a former member of the Nazi Party. So the committee knew his background because they went right to the question of, do you know who he is? And these men handed out letterheads of various members of the Congress, Senators Jackson and Humphrey, who are both dead now. They were targeted then, and they're both dead now. Lenzer, now, did Segretti give you, as part of your campaign dirty tricks, three vials of chemical substance in March of 72? That's correct. He instructed me to locate the liquid substance in the headquarters of Senator Muskie, two headquarters in Tampa, at a picnic. He told me, place them in those headquarters, and they said, could you get in? He said you could throw them or do whatever you had to do with the chemicals. In one building, there was a hole in the window. They dropped the substance through. In another building, it was told by me, the screen was open, the window was open, to drop in the chemicals. Now, they don't say what the chemical was or what it did to these people or anyone in the room, but this is a lawyer working for the United States Army at Fort Ord who's giving chemicals to this man to do dirty tricks at the time of the election at Watergate. It says, did you place them at a picnic? Yes, they took them to the picnic. It was a Senator Muskie picnic, and they emptied the vial at the picnic. Where was it held? On the grounds of the Mary Help of Christians Church School. That's where it was. The chemical. Getting back to the picnic where the chemical was distributed, do you recall what the FBI agents who interviewed you said about the picnic? And did you attend the picnic? He says he didn't attend it. He went there, left the vials of chemicals, and doesn't say what they were supposed to do or how you received the chemicals or what the audience got out of it. But they were some purpose because you're getting calls and letters and you're being paid a salary to put chemicals there. I bring this evidence up because I keep saying how people are chemically altered individually by groups, attending groups. This happens to be a very innocent church group. Now, it's Mr. Talmadge said, I believe you had two subordinates. One was Mr. Duke and the other was named Mr. Hearing. Yes, his name was Duke. Okay, did Mr. Hearing tell you that Duke was a former SS officer for Adolf Hitler's stormtroopers? Correct, he did. Talmadge said, did you feel that being trained by Adolf Hitler and his stormtroopers particularly qualified him for the duties that you assigned to him? I don't know of any training school that would train him for this work, Ben said. And Talmadge said, were not the activities similar? Did not Hitler's Nazi stormtroopers perform similar activities to what you were engaged in Florida? He said, I don't know. And Talmadge said, well, you've read history of the period, haven't you? You've read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. Are not the activities of the Nazi stormtroopers somewhat similar? He said, I don't recall. And Talmadge said, I thought they were. I read a good many about falsified documents of that era, about libels and slander against the opposition. It was one of the ways I recall that Adolf Hitler came to power. And Sam Irvin said, you mean to tell me that you sincerely believe that you were justified in disseminating false and scurrilous tacks? He doesn't even mention the poison or the chemical on the character of Senator Jackson and Humphrey just to get Richard Nixon elected. And that was part of the Watergate hearings that is never on television. The parts left out, always left out. Who were the stormtroopers that were recruited by Donald Segretti, an attorney at Fort Ord? Now I get into a personal thing that I have to bring up at this time, and I mentioned a little bit on the talk show that preceded this. Through the years, various things have happened to our family, and I have two cassettes that are available for you. I haven't updated it, but they're available. And this last week, my son on his answering machine got three calls, one with a background of birds with a smart aleck reference to something that he didn't know about. The second was a woman's voice saying that we are going to kill you, that you're followed everywhere, every night, and you're going to be killed. Now, we have had a lot of things happen to the family, and my children are not paranoid considering so many things that have happened. And afterwards or during the week, my son was at the house, and I got several phone calls, work related to what I was doing, and he said, for goodness sakes, get off the air. Don't continue this on the air. You're obviously rustling up too many people at this time with these programs about Edwin Meese III and Ronald Reagan's appointments. And he says, I don't want to be bloodied, laid out, you know, because of this one more time. There are other people out there, and our family has paid their dues. Now, I mentioned Bernard Fensterwald, the attorney for James McCord at the Watergate hearings. He was the one that said that stood by him and represented him. Fensterwald was at my home in September 1970, and about 6 weeks later was the car accident that my daughter was killed in and the other daughter was almost killed. The accident involved a soldier from Fort Ord where Donald Segretti was stationed, and I read you particularly the testimony of his working with the SS stormtroopers. Segretti was at Fort Ord. The gentleman involved who walked away from this accident where three people were killed and six were badly wounded was at Fort Ord. He left within days or hours and went back to Salt Lake City to Utah. And I have some pieces of the puzzle, but it's believe it or not, it's still too hurting to get into the details of this thing. When Watergate broke, the men were hired, James McCord, G. Gordon Liddy, and Segretti's money all came out of Mullen Associates. The public relations office in Washington linked to the CIA and the Defense Department and to Salt Lake City, Utah, to former Representative Bennett and the Mormon connections, the Utah connections, and the Howard Hughes organization in Utah. And this is where this fellow went, Mr. Garcia, right after the accident. So the Watergate thing came to mind, and also many of you know the letter in 1967 that the FBI wrote to various agencies that I got from Freedom Information Act that information about me should be sent to the Department of Justice and the United States Secret Service and the attention of the General Investigative Agency because Mrs. Brussel, in quotes, in the past, expressed great alarm over the fact that the United States is becoming fascist. She pictures America as controlled by conspirators in the government, which view she stated publicly. Well, you on the air are my public audience. They said, due to her thinking that she has said publicly, Dallas and San Francisco are to incorporate this information into their letterheads for dissemination to the Department and U.S. Secret Service. So since 1967, I have been under their surveillance. And also Bruce Roberts, who wrote the Gemstone File, wrote about the car accident. Before I knew him, he had written who set up the car accident and the names of the people. Incidentally, the powers that be in Washington had used some mafia figures in San Jose whose names are identified. And the first call that my son got this week said, you ordered four pizza, and where in the heck are you? You didn't buy them. And the pizza business and the mozzarella cheese are strongly linked even to those areas that we tangled with before. Coincidental, maybe. Making a lot out of nothing, I don't know. But all the years that I have been on the air, the family have not asked me to slow down. There was a time when I did go off the air and the tapes went on continuously. I've been on for 13 years, but I did it by subscription, and I'll be doing it again by subscription. And at that time, a lot of things were happening around me, and the girls were acting in a play at the Barnyard Theater here. And a fellow by the name of Mr. Selmayr was managing the theater, and his brother Dean wanted to work there. Well, in 1979, just the time when I was under pressure, and I went back on the air in 1980 because Ronald Reagan was going to become the Fuhrer, and I wanted to speak out about the intricacies and Gestapo connections of Reagan. In 1979, Viking Press came out with a book that I've mentioned on other broadcasts called Blow Away, by Dean Selmayr and Mark Cramp. And the book describes a man. It says this is the autobiography of a professional killer who decided to go public. He's not a pseudonym. It's a stage and screen actor. He kills for a living. He got in trouble when in the armed forces, and he was offered a chance to get out of the army and a long hitch in the prison if he was willing to take a lethal assignment. So under the cover of being an actor, he was in the Broadway show, The Ballad of the Sad Cafe. He went around killing people as a paid killer. Well, Donald Segretti was in the Army, and he could release people from the Army, the brig there, and other Army officials. Release people caught on drugs or other things and say, if you will do killings of particular people for us, we will get you out of the Army prison. So he was acting in Broadway plays, and he was hanging people on meat hooks. Now, just coincidentally, I got a letter from his first cousin this week. She was in Los Angeles and read about my father's passing away and sent me a condolence call. I know his brother up on the peninsula and his nephew took a course that we taught at Monterey Peninsula College on the American assassinations. This is a home product from the Monterey Peninsula, and at the time he wanted to work at the theater where my girls were was the time when I was... I didn't know him. I knew his brother and I knew the history, but I was feeling uncomfortable. Also in the Monterey Herald this last week is an article, Edwin Meese will be exonerated, his lawyer says. Edwin Meese's attorney was in Monterey just last week talking to a group of the Monterey County Bar Association at the Holiday Inn. Now that's a local group, but on our peninsula we have two of the most important attorneys in the United States in terms of what I'm doing. There's Melvin Belli, whose offices are about a block and a half from this station, who is now representing the lawsuit against the Soviet Union on the Korean Airline. He's very anti-Russian. He was Jack Ruby's attorney, and he's right here in this area, and I'm doing broadcast week after week and writing articles on the kamikaze provocateur setup of the Korean Airline for the kind of propaganda which he, in fact, is continuing. And John McCone of the CIA was director of the CIA. He was on the board of ITT when they coaxed Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon to kill Salvador Allende to keep the price of copper up in Chile. The board of the copper companies wants their big profit and the telephone wires come from that copper. I'm not blaming these people, but what I'm saying is that there's a whole lot of people around here, attorneys. Mr. McCone's a Knight of Malta, along with Alexander Haig and William Casey and Strong, the Vatican connections. The areas that I'm hitting are not separate from the area that I'm talking about. I happen to be living in a nest of people that I assume don't want to touch me, but I assume if I went too far, could do harm to my children, because it's happened already. And it's happened once. One was poisoned, one was killed, and one was almost killed. So I have to pull back, as I say, the attorney for Edwin Meese, E. Robert Wallach, coincidentally just happened to be here on the Monterey Peninsula. He flew in from Washington, D.C. He said the political flap over Meese's nomination has faded from the headlines, and our greatest success so far has been removing it from the media. We'll take a 1-minute break and then go back to that subject.